Okay, so we are in episode number 9 in our podcast from the Ganga to Himalaya, and today we are do with Dr. Nanda Kishore, and we wanted to speak about Queen Elizabeth II death and the complicated relationship between the British Raj and Indian, the heritage of Queen Elizabeth. Dr. Kishore is an associate professor the Department of Politics and International Studies from the University of Alamabad. I hope I don't, if I miss something, please correct me. You also holds a PhD from in political science, and you are a fellow a fellowship associate in University of Leiden. Did I miss something out with your impressive resumes?
No, it's absolutely fine.
Okay, thank you. You will join us today to speak about the British heritage, and we'll start about about the remarks of Tucker Carlson. A lot of people try to summarize the era of the late Queen Elizabeth II. One of them was the Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson. He chose to glorify the British legacy, the democracy, the civil service, the English language, the infrastructure, and so on. This glorification of the British Empire costs a lot of Indians and activists to be rage and to be really surprised about it. What is your position in that matter?
I think there's no big surprise. I think every now and then you would find that coming from the partially white supremacist idea, looking at this part of the world as third world and looking at this part of the world as comparatively less civilized, and as if they came, or the whites or the British came, and then subsequently they went on civilizing different parts of the world. So they would not want to say they colonized, but rather they would want to say they civilized. You know, that's a simple way of putting it across. And they would still say wherever they went, I think it was good for those people. And what they would want to mask the commercial part, the way they exploited, the way they interfered, the way they meddled with the local culture, religion, their practices to everything. But they would want to simply put across and say that they have done this one because there was a necessity, and then Indians were not as civilized as the British.
Yeah. So you say that it's like a cleaning word to say that the colonial time was actually for the good of India.
That's what the whites want us to believe. That's what the Europeans want us to believe. But the truth is that their history and our history, if you look in, India is a civilizational state. India has its own civilizational past, and that past has never been accused of being, let's say, ferocious. That's not been accused of bullying anyone. That's not been accused of taking over someone else's land or colonizing anyone or showing the imperial part of the country or anything of that sort. So they may think that they have done good by coming here, and they may think that they have civilized us. We have a difference of opinion with regard to that. We have our own ways of looking at it, that they did greater damage than that of doing good to us.
Yes, one of the thing that I cross into when I preparing for this episode is like that the part of India in the under the Mughal Empire was at something around like quarter from the GDP of the world, and when the British left, it stood on like 4%, or like Indian was a great exporter of taking example cotton to each part of the world, but when the British left, in 1947, they became like an importer, and they only could provide like 8% of their inside domestic request. So the tables have turned, like in economic economically speaking, India became like less developed after the Indian left. If we talk like on the, like very in like in specific terms.
Yeah, 1700s, India and China together held almost half of world's GDP. If China was having 24%, India was having somewhere around 21% to 20%. So that together almost makes it half of the world's GDP being in just two countries, that is India and China. And then we subsequently see what happened by the 1800s, and more so when the British started interfering too much into, and then they started draining out India. It always used to be the case. They used to take the raw material, that's cotton from here, take it to Manchester and bring back the finished product and charge us more than what was supposed to be. In the sense, they would charge it for the double the price, and then they would expect Indians only to buy. So India served as a place from where resources came in, that's in the form of raw materials. Secondly, India served also as a market for their finished product. So they
Yes.
used our own product and they sold it to us only. And then they became richer. And then they drained us out in 1947. As you mentioned, we had nothing. It was 0.00%, whatever that is. It was all in those minuscule things. India became a poor nation from being part of, let's say, holding up to 20% or more than 20% of the world's GDP. We drifted back to nothing in the world. We were nothing except for our moral authority or moral power. India was not considered anything. Now, that's the contribution that the British made, and none of them ever apologized, never, none of them ever felt that they need to apologize to the Indian citizens.
Yeah, we'll get that later about the thing to apologize because it's a very interesting point. The main question is, in your view, whether the British Raj action was were the benef were for the benefit of the Indian people or it was for their own good. I mean, has it been for like a byproduct of their doing or the main purpose was for to benefit the Indian? Like taking for example. Like the railways, a lot of there are opinion that says that they built it not for the Indians, but to export all the minerals that they extracted from India. But I would like to hear your opinion, but on this subject. But another example is the Sati, like the East India Company, not even the English regime, the East India Company prohibited this I don't know how to call it, that widows would be burned after their husband has died, and which took a lot of courage to do so. I mean, maybe we could find in their own doing something that were for the benefit of Indians.
See, I would give what they tried doing in terms of the social reforms, maybe a 10 to 20%, but 80% was more of a damage that they did. One, yes, you mentioned, I'll start with the last point of yours, that is on Sati. Indeed, every society has its own contradictions. Every society has its own ways of degeneration, and every society has its own ways of course correction. And India is no less with regard to, or India is no exception with regard to that one. So in our case, yes, Sati was a different type of a practice. It was practiced initially as an voluntary. You can imagine when the kings were there, and then there would be plunderers who would come in the sense that is one of the ways of looking at it. Even after losing the wars, many of them used to take women as a trophy. Many of them used to think that capturing women and then having them under the control used to be one of the ways of satisfying their own ego. So a section within the society felt at some point of time that they should not give themselves to the men. It happened more like a voluntary system. And then slowly and steadily, every society, as I mentioned, contradiction in our condition also, it happened so that it started becoming a bad practice where after the marriage, if the husband dies along with his pyre, they will also would push the lady, or many times they themselves would get into. So whichever way, it was a bad practice, no doubt about it. I don't think there is any society in the world which did not have an amount of patriarchy. I think patriarchy is there and will be there, and it was there in the past too. From that perspective, if you ask me, yes, they perhaps were a little advanced than us, and they helped out some of the Indians to come up with this one, and then subsequently they banned this practice. This is one side of the story. But the other side of the story is also that without understanding how a particular social system works, they also were interfering on a regular basis. They would not understand certain religious symbols. They would not understand certain social practices. They would also not understand many other things that were there. But that this all came because of that high-headedness and also of the thought that they are superior than us. That is one of the reasons why they would put up a poster and say, or a board in front of a bungalow or anywhere, Indians and dogs are not allowed. Now you can imagine if that's a perception or that's a perspective that they would come with, that means they already had decided that Indians are worth not emulating. And they also wanted to see only what they wanted to see. This is one part of the story. And they also were very, very clear that they would want to introduce the English system of education to everything because they just could not understand. If one cannot understand, perhaps there is no value in that they find in that one. If they could not understand, let's say, in your terms, if somebody came and they could not understand Hebrew and they don't find value in Hebrew, and then they would impose English, and then they would say English system of education is superior. This is exactly what was done to India as well. They could not understand Sanskrit. They could not understand many other languages because India has so many languages and so many dialects. They just could not get a hold of that one. So it would also affect their own administration if they were able to bring in one language, and then perhaps that would be very helpful for them. And they also require foot soldiers. They also require people who can work at the lower ranks because UK did not have such population to have offices all over the world in their colonies. So they also required second rank, third rank, and the lower rank officers and foot soldiers to be part of the system. So it was for their own necessity. They also introduced the education system. It was not just to humanize the so-called quote unquote humanize Indians or educate Indians as if Indians did not have an education.
Just a minute. So if we'll take the language, for example, one of the things that India now is very proud, and a lot of the high-tech industry and the industry in India, and a lot of invention in India is thankful for the very high level of English in India. Is it not something that you feel that India should be thankful to the British because they planted the knowledge of this language, which now is very crucial for business and for studies in the world, in the globalized world?
But I would simply say, even before the colonizers came, do we mean to say that there was no business across? The Chinese had their Silk Road. Indians, through their civilization, always had a connect towards Greece. They had towards Mesopotamia. We had connections to different parts of the world. It is this conditioning of the mind just because they colonized different parts of the world. And through colonies, they pushed their people and English-speaking people, and they established. Today, English has become important. English has been created to make, or it was pushed to become important. Otherwise, I don't think it was a necessity for, or even otherwise, it at no point of time can say it is only because of English people have become civilized or it is useful. Yes, today I do agree because these people went and colonized all parts of the world in different parts of the world. English has become a predominant language, more so because we have a superpower that is the United States that speaks English. So because of that, now English has become part of it. Yes, from that perspective, India has gained being part of the Anglosphere. I would call it as Anglosphere. You have New Zealand, you have Australia. You have UK, you also have the United States and few others who speak English. So to an extent that has happened. Otherwise, just imagine the world. Had the British not colonized, where would have been English? There would have been no Australia. There would have been no New Zealand. There would have been no United States. It is they who pushed themselves and imposed a language at some point of time. At no point of time in history, it ever says that they required common language to trade or to survive. People
Yes.
did by themselves. The Japanese spoke Japanese. The Chinese spoke Chinese. They spoke the Mandarin. Indians spoke whatever the languages that they had. And people in Europe spoke what they have, what they had. In different places, people spoke different languages and they learned how to survive. The people in the Arab world spoke Arabic. It is after imposing English through colonialism, they made English being a superpower at one point of time, they made English almost like a language that has to be reckoned with. And had there been no United States, I don't think there would have been so much of value for the British to survive.
So what
I
you
hope
say,
I have made the point clear.
yeah, so what you say, it's like before, like English, England conquer a lot of part of the world, people find ways to trade, like
Absolutely.
when different language and different culture separated between them, and like there was no need to be educated or to run like financial or trade relationship by knowing the other's language or specific language. Although you say, you admit that today it's very crucial to function in the world where the United States and even most of Europe like use English as official language.
Yeah, that is because there's something called United States that's only largely speaks English. And though we don't have so much of respect, or there is no such great place for UK in the international system now, especially after the Second World War, had there been no United States and an English speaking country like United States, and everything was pushed through, the trade was pushed through dollars, I don't think this would have been a major case of concern. Am I right? So even that's a case with Israel.
Yes.
The connection of Israel with the United States is much more than that of UK. So there is a direct connection, and then there is a direct influence. So in our case also, this whole conditioning to make it to look like that had there been no British, we would have not have the value in the world, perhaps is pathetic, because whatever we speak in India, to a large extent, we speak like we have Indianized the English. We don't speak like the British English. We still have our own ways of, but we can manage. I think when it is compared with, let's say, with Japan or with China or with some other non-English speaking country, I think we have a cutting edge. I think we have a little better space than them. And that has happened by default. And Indians decided to be that way. Indians decided to have a language. And then we are okay with that one. But the idea of pushing that had there been no English, had there been no British, what would have been our condition? I don't think that's an acceptable one.
Okay. And like before we move to the other subject, like final word about railways, which is now is the larger employer of people in India, and it's one of the things that India proud the most and toward people outside and inside. Do you think that even part of the British railways were not for the good of the local Indians?
Yes, I do agree, because they created whatever they did it systematically. I don't deny that one. Whether it comes to building bridges or dams, or for that matter, the railways, I think whatever they did this systematically. That's why perhaps when Carlson said that after the Chhatrapati Shivaji terminus, I don't think after India got independence, they were able to build a magnificent structure like that of one. He was referring to a railway station in Mumbai. That's what Carlson speaks about, which I partially agree with. We have also built marvels, not now. The British built only a small one, including that of something like a Pisa Tower. We have a temple that has a much greater tilt and it's been surviving. Indian engineering doesn't require help from anyone else. It's been there from the past. Now, when it comes to railways, very specific question of railways, yes, I do agree that though they did it for their own survival, they also did to make sure that that they were able to get the raw materials from place to place, and also in terms of the transport, it was very helpful. I do agree on that front. Yes, India used that one, and then subsequently we have built upon that one, and we have also become one of the largest network in the world. But I'll give you a contrast example. We have something called as the Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO in India.
Yes.
Okay, the space research one. Until the 1960s and the 70s, India was denied technology by all the major powers. Nobody helped. And then we also went through partial sanctions, and quite a few things happened. And they started with a bullock cart, they started with nothing, and slowly and steadily they built upon. Today, ISRO is one of the giants in the space research. ISRO is competing with the best of the best space research organizations in the world, and we also made a record of sending or having a Mars mission with the least amount of money that was ever spent. Now, what I'm trying to say is that Indians by nature are entrepreneurial, and at the same time they are skilled enough. If we were plundered for hundreds and hundreds of years, and in less than 70 years we have come to where we are, and we are the type of an economy that we are, and we are still there as a service sector. The whole of the Silicon Valley in the United States has Indians and the Chinese, and Indians have made their footmark in most of the places, though we still say perhaps the Israelis are much smarter than us. But in all occasions, I would still say that had there been no help from the British, had they not built, we don't imagine a scenario that we would have not had railways at all. But they built something, we learned something from them, and then we went on to. I partially would want to attribute that one to as one good thing that they did. Even that's the same case with postal system. I do agree the postal system was built by them. And there are also other good things that would have to come in, though they are also being pushed for their purpose. But I still feel somewhere that there is nothing wrong in giving due credit to the British with regard to that one, though it served their purpose. But I don't agree that had there been no British, we would have not had such type of railways, or we would have not had anything else. That is the reason, in contrast, I had to give the space research organization's example.
Okay, interesting. Another surprising thing is that the way there is a debate about Churchill legacy in India. Like Churchill in the West is considered to be an icon of freedom and a warrior for the safe of the world. But in India, there is a debate about his responsibility for the Bengal famine in 2043. So, how do you stand in that debate? Like in India, not all the people like appreciate for his role in the famine.
No, absolutely. Because first and foremost, let's talk about the World War One. World War One had nothing to do with India. We yet sacrificed more than 70,000 people for the war that was not ours, right? And it's all because we were under the British India. When it came
Yes.
to the Second World War, again, the same inducement was done, same way they spoke about, saying that one, if you can actually, what is it, work for us and you send people for us, then we will be able to advance your freedom. This is what was told to us. But until and unless Indians pushed for, and Indians went, the best part was that we went non-violent. That was Gandhi's idea, and Gandhi pushed for all these things. But in the meanwhile, simultaneously, they were ruling India, but they never treated us as on par or the citizens of UK. They did not treat us like the subjects of the Queen. The subjects of the Queen was mentioned only when it for their convenience on papers, but we were never treated that way. Had the British, because we were already under the princely states, different rulers were there, and there were small kingdoms. Had the British treated Indians with little more dignity, perhaps would have never taken offense to whatever they did if they had shown an amount of benevolence. But here was a classic case. They were draining everything and anything from here. There was nothing called food security. There was no proper system of governance to help out the people. People were dying. People were starving. People were starving to death. And then there were famines. You can imagine if a famine comes in, what type of scenario that would be there. And the British at no point of time even felt a minimal responsibility towards the citizens. They never felt that it was failure of their governance. If they were ruling India, it is failure of their governance. But they never owed responsibility. They never apologized. They never said that it was something that we could have avoided or we could have worked on, and we would have not allowed perhaps so many people to die. And they went blind.
Just focus for a second in Churchill himself. As I understand, like when the bodies were piling up in Bengal and in Kolkata, there were a lot
Yes.
of officials, British officials in India, that sending information to England about the need to send like a food supply to help or to export food from England to India to fight the famine. But Churchill refused to do that, and his claim, as I understand, was that he don't have nor the time nor the resources to take from the war and from the soldier to give to India. So, like the local officials, as I understand, were in favor and really understood the horrifying tragedy that took place. But like the really big boss, as I see, didn't understand the meaning of the famine.
Yeah, see, Churchill had a different opinion. See, Churchill first and foremost saw Indians more like a filthy human beings. He never felt that there was a dignity that was attached to human life. That is first and foremost part. The rice stocks continued to leave India even as London was denying urgent requests from the Indian Viceroy at that particular point of time, speaking about the emergency wheat supplies that were supposed to come to India in 42-43. Churchill, in fact, was quoted saying, the way he spoke about with such denigration, he said, Indians were breeding like rabbits. And he also asked, if the shortage was so bad, how was Gandhi surviving? This is what was his question. That means he was saying, still there are some people who are troubling British India are surviving. That means, I don't think there is anything that sort of, which is also called as the denial policy, if you look in. Because this is a time, because Bengal has been part of that one quite a few times before as well. We in India had a Bihar famine that was from 1870 through to 74, and then subsequently the Bengal famine. So every now and then, because of the dependency or over dependency on the monsoons, over dependency on just the rainwater that would come in. So he never understood, and he neither was able to respond. He in fact saw this as another way perhaps to reduce the Indians, or this is another way of putting a break to the freedom movement itself, right? Because there are certain scholars who openly say this was caused, or the whole famine was caused, because of policy failure rather than just the monsoon itself. They also say, had the British thought about us, it would have not happened that way, because most of the stocks that were kept in India were all taken away by the British. They never bothered that there had to be enough stocks that have to be kept here for the food security of the Indians, but they felt it was supposed to be. The number, what is the cost that we went through? 3 million Indians died.
Yes.
3 million. And then Mr. Churchill thinks that Indians were breeding like rabbits and there were enough stocks, but we ate too much and we bred too much, due to which there was not enough stocks to manage.
Yes.
This is a perception. So you can imagine, if somebody sat over the corpse of 3 million people, how would you expect Indians to respect Churchill? He might be a great leader for others, but for Indians, certainly not.
Yeah.
Though this is such a huge country, and Bengal is one side of the country, it's in the eastern part of the country. But that does not mean the other parts won't feel the pain of what those individuals must have gone through, the horrific times in which they must have died out of hunger. Right? So
yeah.
Winston Churchill doesn't deserve an ounce of respect from Indians, and he will never get it also.
Yeah. If we continue in that line, Shashi Tharoor, who aspired to be the president of the Congress Party, feels, and he is talking about it openly in a lot of forums, that the Britain should pay reparation to Indian for the British rule. He says that that the reparation should be as a payout of for the 35 million Indians that died of starvation, and for the taxes and all the exploitation of Indian. Now, as I understand, like reparation is not new. Like Muammar Gaddafi and Silvio Berlusconi signed the reparation treaty in 2008. Which concluded an apology for the colonial time, which concluded investment in Libya, which concluded a free visa for students for studies and also for immigration. Do you think like reparation would be which also like concluded those ingredients as apologies for the colonial time will be like just could summarize for the British Raj, for the British conqueror in England, in India?
Well taken, but point number one, the British, I don't think they have that amount of money that they looted from this, from my country, that they can return ever. That is the first part.
Yes.
Right. Second is what Dr. Tharoor is asking, rightfully asking, is to pay for all that he has listed out. I don't think that the British will be able to even pay for what they have plundered from here in the form of gifts. Even just to return those gifts, I don't think they will ever be able to do. Whole of their museum, whatever that they're claiming and they're showing in UK, those are all stolen artifacts. We would openly claim that everything that they're showing in the museum is all stolen, right? That's the first part. They have an apology to owe, or they owe an apology for that factor itself. Second part is also what Dr. Tharoor is insisting, that of all these things, apart from the cost, at least they should have that minimum courtesy to apologize. We have 1919, we had something called the Jallianwala Bagh, where innocent children, women, everybody was massacred. The Sikh population who were there, belonging to the Sikh religion, they were the ones who were massacred, and they never apologized about it. In fact, at places, they claimed championship about it, that they were able to control them. In the same way, there are so many accounts in which they damaged India and they took away things from here. I don't think even if for the next 50 years, even if they are trying to pay back whatever that they have plundered from here, they will have anything. They are already, their economy is not running that great. You can see them every now and then, they're changing their prime ministers because they're not able to handle their economy. They're struggling day in and day out. I don't think they have the capacity to pay back India at this juncture. So, but at least the magnanimity that they need to show is that what they did was abusive, what they did was not acceptable, and it was inhuman to rule over someone else and eat their food, and yet you claim that you ate rightfully or you took it rightfully. So Dr. Tharoor is absolutely right when it comes to asking for reparations, but does UK have the capacity to pay for it? Does the UK have an economy? It should, if it's able to take care of itself as UK, that is more than enough. I don't think they have capacity to pay back whatever the Indians deserve, and which we rightfully deserve. It's not that they're doing any charity. It's our money. It's our artifacts. It's our gifts. It's our jewels. Everything is ours. That they
talk about that Britain have no ability today to pay all the funds that were taken while Britain conquered India. But beside the ability, I don't think that there is a will. I saw a lot of polls, and also I saw the reaction of a politician, of journalists, and the people itself, that when they asked about British Raj in India, would they say that India were better off or better with the British Raj? They feel like the British regime did good for India, and that it was that if India were not conquered but by the Britain, then its situation were worsen than today. So they don't even accept the notion to apologize because they don't feel they had to, or vice versa. They feel like that India should be grateful for the English area, the English era, and the English conquer in those years.
In fact, this view comes from those who are blind to history. Secondly, they might have not been educated, where in their history textbooks to all those places on history, the British might have given a fairy tale, or they must have also given them education, saying that the British went all over the world. They went and educated people and civilized them. So if I am born and brought up with that, I've never had an exposure. I've never been to Africa. I've never been to India. I've never been to any of these places. Naturally, I think my country is great. I will also think that all these countries are better off because the British went there and British civilized them. That's what I'm going to be educated. If they really come and have a direct or a first-hand exposure and experience, perhaps they will change. That is the part. Secondly, if they have already got a supremacist idea in their mind, that they are a superior race or they are of superior quality in the world compared to others, nobody can change it. And that's a mindset. As you said, it is true that many of them are not willing to do that one, or there is no political will to do that one. Even when India is asking for, India is not asking for reparation or any of these things. And just because they think that UK has enough money, India knows that they don't have such capacity, neither they will be able to do. But what India expects decently is a decent apology, a sincere apology. That is more than enough. India is not in a position that we need to take money from UK and survive. I think we are well off with whatever that we have been able to achieve in the last 75 years, though it might not be extraordinarily satisfactory, but I think we are progressing well. I think we are making our own inroads into world economy. And we will slowly and steadily progress. Nothing can stop us. That is what I can say. We don't need to survive by whatever they are going to give us back. And they need not feel that way, but at least a sincere apology for the atrocities that they did in my country is good enough.
Okay, in that term, like now there is a conversation about free trade agreement between India and Britain, and we see that Britain is very keen to sign that free trade. But UK Home Minister Suala Braverman implied a few reservations, which one of the most is like India is in the top of overstays visa over each country, and in India was very assaulted from those remarks, and they like put aside the negotiation of free trade, and the reaction from the British side was like it's very childish, like Indian should also apply the law, but it seems like there is like emotional like sub contents between those remarks.
Yeah, see, when the Home Secretary said something like that, she is in direct contradiction with her Prime Minister when it comes to the Migration and Mobility Partnership, that's called as the MMP. Because the Prime Minister is keen that before the Diwali, that's the festival that's coming in, the Festival of Lights, before that one, she would want the FTA to be signed and she would want to see that one as one of the ways of taking forward India-UK relations, and she knows the value behind it. But whereas the
Well,
UK Secretary.
just sorry for stopping you. Why it's so important for Britain to sign it? What will the benefit for Britain from the free trade agreement? I would.
Absolutely, because India is the third largest economy, and Indian economy is much more stable. India is doing well. And compared to the British, the type of gas prices and the type of domestic issues that they're having, certainly they need good friends. They also need those of them who can stand by them. Till now, for some time, many of them had this idea that the Chinese will feel fit to that one. I think since the COVID broke, I think that the Chinese angle has actually taken a beat, and they have not been able to continue with them in that perspective. So India is much more a stable partner, and India is a space that is capable of providing a lot of other inputs for UK from the perspective of, let's say, the skilled labor goes from India to UK and whatever that they are performing. It's not that every other person is going there. It might be whatever the Home Secretary says. To an extent, it's true that Indians might be overstaying. But that does not mean that Indian High Commission is not actually doing anything. Indian High Commission is ready to help or ready to join hands with UK Home Department to whatever that has to be done. But at the same time, under the program of MMP, UK also has to fulfill to certain requirements. The visa regime has to be made much more human. Visa regime also has to be fulfilling to certain things that they have already promised. Otherwise, expecting things to just happen overnight will not. India has openly said, and it has reacted to this one, and it has openly said that we are ready to do or we are ready to fulfill to whatever that has been asked for. I can just read out the Indian High Commissioner said, as part of our wider discussion under the migration and mobility, the Government of India is committed to working with the Government of UK to facilitate the return of Indian citizens who have overstayed their visa period here in the UK. This is what they have openly said. They are ready to help out. So a mere accusation that India is not doing anything, it's only the British who are trying to do is perhaps not acceptable. And at the same time, we also said, as per the data shared with the Home Office, as of date, action has been initiated in all cases referred to by the High Commission. Further, the UK has also undertaken to fulfill certain commitments as part of the migration and mobility program, on which we wait demonstrable progress. This is what UK said. On both the sides, there are counts that one has to agree with. I don't think it's going to be a single hand and a clap. It is both the hands that have to come together. There are issues that UK also faces as a nation with so much of issue. And perhaps this flare up from the UK Home Secretary, I see, was a sort of clash that happened between in certain places between two different communal groups. And that led to some of these issues of talking about different country and the people overstaying here. And India has very clearly demonstrated, and India has very clearly said that we are ready to help out with whatever that is. We will take action on those overstays. Whatever the British are going to take, we will negotiate, we will do this one. But India was also talking about the visas also to be part of the FTA, on free trade agreements, part of it. There, where perhaps there is a small issue that's coming in. The Prime Minister is very keen. The UK Prime Minister is very keen to have that as part of that one, and she would want to ease out the regime. But whereas the Home Secretary, so I think I see it as a home problem. I see it as the problem, internal problem of UK, where the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary are not able to be on the same front.
Yes.
And India has very minimal to do. India said that we are ready to help out and we are ready to do something like that. But making a remark of saying that when Indians are the only one, perhaps you should also give data about others, how many countries and how many people are overstaying. Just pointing out only India might not actually go well or augur well with whatever the larger policy pictures that India is trying to look at, India and UK are trying to look at.
Okay. If we take, but the personal angle for that thing is like Suala Braverman is a daughter of Tamili mother, as I understand, for a father that is from Goa origin. She also had remarks about the Leicester riots that Indian immigrants were responsible for the riots. Now, I wondered to myself, like, if we take like the Israeli example, like there was a lot of Jews in the American institution and government and officials which sometimes like gave the feeling that they wanted to prove the commitments to America is before the commitment for the Jewish country or for the Israeli. Like say, well, I don't know if you remember a Minister Cohen, the defense minister in United States, where he refused to agree that Israel will sell IWACS planes to China. And it was a deal that already was approved, and then he came and he say, okay, I don't agree. Do you feel like it, that maybe the tables have turned? Like m maybe now, like Indians as immigrants feel like the need to prove that their first and immediate commitment is not for their community or their homes, but to the nation which they belong to, and Swala Braverman is now like a British citizens.
Maybe. I think this is an issue of the diaspora. What happens is that at times you get into an identity crisis, or you would want to prove yourself much more than where you belong to. So at times you perhaps want to play to the gallery, and then you want to satisfy certain people. And then you say these things to show that you are greater citizen of the UK than the people who have been there much, much before her. She might have gone and she had taken a naturalized citizenship there. So perhaps she might be into that one. But we also have the other side of the story. We also had someone who ran for the prime minister's position who could not succeed, Sunak, right?
Yes.
So, but I don't think he ever had that as an issue. Maybe Braverman has identity crisis, which is not there with Sunak. Sunak has been respected much more than the Home Secretary, if I suppose. And I think diaspora every time goes through this one. You know, till they attain citizenship, they speak in one manner. After that one, they're expected to show their loyalty, absolute loyalty to the country that has given them citizenship. Whereas the other ones who continue to have their deep roots in the country that they belong to, they will continue to have their love. It does not mean that they like UK less and then they like India more. I think that's a very, very wrong way of an interpretation given by the Home Secretary, because she herself was dividing, and she's making them conscious that they belong to somewhere else. But the moment we create that idea of we and they, then perhaps it's going to be more and more problematic. For the Leicester, there is a deep history, there is a different type of problem and other things. That's why I said, no, she might have been agitated with the Leicester, this thing, and the larger brunt could have been on her, where they might have seen her as a failure as Home Secretary. But that does not mean she can just accuse someone else and then try to prove her identity that she's a greater US, sorry, UK citizen, and forget her roots and then think that where she belongs to. Perhaps that's her way, her modus operandi, which perhaps may not be the case with many others. Many others, they might have been UK citizens, US citizens, or citizens of some other country. They still have great love for India, from the land where they originated. And maybe in this case, I think she wants to be a greater British than the British themselves.
Christine, in another episode, maybe we should talk how is India is feel so comfortable and not even comfortable. It's just also encourage like Indian students, very talented students, to go abroad instead of maybe keeping them inside. And yes, as you said, they are becoming the CEO of Google, and like they could taking places in all the financial and the high-tech industry. But how is India is okay with letting her educated and very talented students to go aboard? This is one point that we
Maybe
should.
you're talking about the brain drain, how a
Yes.
lot of them are leaving India on occasions and then they're in different
Yeah.
paths. We can talk.
Yeah.
No problem.
How is India like encouraging us? Like she's support for visa for students. It's like to like in a way to give them the ability to go out from India, like to take out all the education that India invested and to import it to the UK and to United States.
It happens so. See, at times when the whole transaction is in dollars, and dollar is 80 rupees, 80 Indian rupees. Naturally, dollars is much more than that one. So they would want to earn faster than. And secondly, in terms of the investment with the type of population that we have for a country, 1.3 billion people, and then how much India can do, how much India cannot do, are also certain questions that we need to think about. Whatever the places that we are able to. So there is always this question that comes to, if Indian can lead a Google, why something like a Google could not start in India? If Indian can lead a Microsoft, why a Microsoft could not start in India? Why are we stuck? Where exactly is the problem? It's a diagnosis that I regularly ponder over, I regularly think about as well. Now, there is brain drain, no doubt about it. We invest them in what we call as the premier institutions called Indian Institute of Manage, sorry, Indian Institute of Management and also Indian Institute of Technology. These two are very premier institutions, and they get education with a very, very meager price, and then they fly off to the United States or fly off to UK or fly out to some of the European states and other things. It is a serious issue, there's no doubt about it. But good number of them are also staying back in India, and good number of them are finding now, because there are startups, there are different other ways of helping people with technology, entrepreneurs, to a lot of other things. Slowly and steadily it's happening. But it might not immediately happen and show so much of progress, but it will certainly happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So, thank you, Dr. Kishore. Thank you for
No
your time.
problem.
It was really educated and really interesting to talk with you, and I really
No
appreciated
problem.
your time dedicated for us. Thank you.
No problem. Take care and do visit India. Anytime you're welcome to come to India, be our guest.
Thank you. I'm